Welcome to the Tour Life Podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is a certified addictions counselor with 10 years of experience in the music industry. He currently has 16 years of direct clinical experience with those suffering from addiction and alcoholism. He has worked in all levels of care in the field, including inpatient, outpatient, residential, and private practice, and has direct experience with both interventions and on-tour counseling with musicians. In this episode, we discuss his personal alcohol and addiction story that set him on a path to helping others recover from their own addiction. You can find him on Instagram at Favid Sherman. Here is my conversation with the recipient of the 2009 Karen Foundation's Unsung Hero Award, David Sherman. Dave, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to get to know you and to learn your story and to see how you are such an essential part of what we do when we help people.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get started in the industry in the first place? What's your story when it comes to that?
You know, just music had affected my life profoundly from the time I was a teenager. And I think there was always kind of an underlying thread of feeling the need to be involved in it in some capacity. And in my 20s, I was in a band for about a minute, but I with no talent whatsoever, so that wasn't really an option. But, you know, kind of just promoting open mic nights and getting involved. And then in the mid-90s, ended up working for a label in and out of there. And then the 90s were addiction and alcoholism for me too. So when I got sober in 99, ended up back in the industry, working for labels and then management and a couple other things. But then became an addictions counselor, and somewhere along the line, the two paths kind of crossed, and I ended up working with musicians. It turned into this kind of full-time gig.
So you mentioned that you became sober in 99. What happened?
Then I decided to change and get sober?
Yeah.
A typical alcoholic story. The drugs and alcohol no longer worked. And I was given the opportunity. I'd burned my life to the ground, as many of us do. And I was given the opportunity to go to a treatment facility called Ashley down in Maryland. And I was there about 2 weeks. I was pretty resistant to the whole process. Getting sober seems very culty and weird. And it was something I didn't think I was capable of doing anyway. But I was there about 2 weeks when kind of the light bulb clicked. I was listening to a clinician actually tell his story. And it was just, it paralleled mine a great deal. And literally, it was kind of like a light bulb went off. And I just realized that that's the path I need to be on right now. And that was February 5th, 1999, technically is my sobriety date. So it's been a bit.
Wow. So it's interesting that you say that it seems a little bit culty and kind of off-putting to really embrace, you know, sobriety and the whole culture around it. What was it about that that you found off-putting?
Well, the whole idea of living a life without drugs and alcohol seemed, just the whole teetotaler idea, that was anathema to everything I stood for. I grew up feeling very uncomfortable in my skin. And the only time that I was comfortable in my skin was when I had something in my bloodstream. The artists that I admired, the writers that, were always drug addicts and alcoholics, the Hemingways and the Doors and William Burroughs was a huge fan of. So the idea of giving up, it was so much of my identity. To go hang out in a room full of people that were teetotalers sharing about their feelings and relating to each other. That is just a horrifying concept. Holding hands with that. Are you kidding me? I'm not going to sing Kumbaya. It was literally the most lame thing you could possibly imagine. Until I bought into it. I'm like, all right, this isn't so bad. And of course, I'm getting a career out of all this crap. So, the ultimate irony. There was an aspect of you have to be spiritual in order to recover. And there were just so many things that I was threatened by. We're always seem to be threatened by the things that we're just, you know, afraid of. And then until we actually confront our fears, there's an aspect of the thing that kept me struggling was contempt prior to investigation. And I think that we all need to take a look at our preconceived notions, you know, and if we get rid of those, we'll actually progress and evolve as a person.
Were you aware that you felt contempt toward that?
Oh, no. No, it wasn't my problem. It was that those things were really lame. I was the victim, and what in God's name would I be doing over there with those people that seem really happy? Yeah, no, I was angry about everything, as many alcoholics and addicts are. You know, and I wasn't even in touch with that. I just knew that when I drank, I felt better.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. It's like for people, even when you're not dealing with addiction, when you're just dealing with accepting being happy or accepting love or whatever it is, like a lot of times you just don't want to do it. And I mean, I, as a woman, I remember being in bad relationships over, you know, and over like, or dating people. And if a guy was too nice to me, I'd be like, yeah, I can't handle that. Like, why are you being so nice?
Well, that would bore the crap out of you. But you go find a guy with a meth habit and a face tattoo and you're like, oh, he's totally the one. I'm going to stay in this relationship long past the expiration date.
Why? Why do you think we do that?
Well, there's a disconnect with self-esteem. And if we don't feel worthy of happiness, we will take actions that will reinforce that feeling of low self-esteem and alienation. You know, I mean, the way we feel about ourselves is dictated by our actions. So you date people that there's just no way it's possibly going to work out. And you do everything possible to make it work. Oh, if he just would let me, you know, and it never does. And you end up feeling miserable all the time. You know, we take actions that will fulfill how we feel on the inside. So until we actually, whether it's therapy or recovery or all of the above or eating right, until we actually feel better on the inside, we're going to doom anything on the outside to not work out. You know, you will drive away everything good.
So when did you get to a place where you recognized that, and what led you to recognizing that?
I don't know if there was ever a moment. I mean, all of my progress personally and professionally has been, you know, slow incremental progress over time. I know that very early in recovery, I got involved in service. And by service, I mean, I would go to very low bottom rehabs and tell my story in the hopes of inspiring other people. And whatever that process was, I felt better about myself. So I kind of got hooked on that whole concept. You know, long before I was professional, I was just hanging out in rehabs trying to help. And I just, the whole idea of feeling better organically, as opposed to needing a bag or a bottle or a needle to feel better. And I did that enough times and actually started feeling pretty good about myself on a daily basis. You know, it was one of those where I just kind of slowly filled up that hole inside me with service and being selfless and trying to help others without the expectation of anything in return. You know, when you do that long enough and you suddenly actually start liking yourself and you don't put up with the bullshit. Like if you're in an unhealthy relationship after a couple of weeks, you go, this is totally not working for me, as opposed to trying to make it work for the next 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, and it's got to be therapeutic, you know, to talk about it, because then maybe you have an opportunity once you say it or you write it down to actually see what you're feeling and maybe connect to it a little bit better.
Sure. You know, growing up, I was just completely out of touch. I mean, if you ask me how I was feeling, I was just this, I refer to a van load of 8-year-olds inside my head. I mean, it was just this huge cacophony of noise. You know, and I literally couldn't articulate a sentence about, well, today I'm feeling a little bit anxious because I have an unresolved issue regarding this area of my life. And I'm all depressed because of this, that. I couldn't do that, you know, until I got sober and started actually, you know, naming and claiming and dealing with and articulating. And yeah, that's a process. You know, I'm still a work in progress.
I take it that you believe in a growth mindset, since you do think that you're still a work in progress.
Yeah,
yes?
Sure, totally.
So, did you always think that?
No, I was perfect. And I literally, I remember I was at a support group once and there was a guy talking about how I really thought I was perfect until I realized what incredibly low expectations I was setting for myself. And I was like, ain't that some shit right there? I mean, I was convinced that I was entitled to a life of just being loaded all the time and that I was just entitled to feel good all the time. And I was just going to suddenly get discovered and the world was going to realize how brilliant I was. And yet I hadn't really done anything. I mean, I spent the 90s loaded, working in bars. You know, I mean, it just, there was nothing of brilliance. I didn't write. I didn't act. I didn't do anything that the world would have discovered me, but I was just owed, which is actually a very alcoholic mindset. Like I'm entitled to just be able to do this all the time. You know, it wasn't until I got sober, like, I'm going to have to actually do some work here. and I got to actually accomplish some things we'll probably put on the to-do list.
That's got to be kind of like, I don't know. It's like maybe the substances just kept you blinded, so you never had to really think about it.
Well, I think the thing is, the goal in life is to just feel good and to stop my brain from racing. And once I got loaded, I felt good and it stopped my brain from racing. So like I didn't need to accomplish anything. You know, you'll see that in a lot of people. And once they've got their substance of choice, they're like, okay, I'm good. The problem being alcoholism and addiction or a progressive disease. You know, it gets worse over time. And you need more and more to get less and less of a good feeling. So eventually you get to that point where it no longer works. And that's when you see people either getting into harder and harder substances or getting sober.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Jackie Brown?
The movie?
The movie Jackie Brown. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So Bridget Fonda was smoking pot and watching TV. And Samuel Jackson said, you know, it's going to kill your ambition. And she said, what if it's my ambition to get high and watch TV? And it's like, damn, you know, like that's pretty good. You know, that's most alcoholics. Like, I just want to be loaded all the time. Is that why can't you leave me alone and let me do it? Kills your ambition.
Why do you think that is? Like,
well, I don't, a lot of people, you know, are just angry at themselves for being alcoholics. If I feel totally uncomfortable in my skin all the time and I'm depressed and suicidal and miserable, and then I have a shot and a beer and all of a sudden there's like a gospel choir inside my brain, how do you blame yourself for wanting to do that all the time? You know?
Yeah. I mean, I can relate to, like, I remember I used to drink a lot when I was like in my mid early 20s, okay. I drank a lot and I would sometimes I would black out. Oh. And I realized later on that I did it a lot when I was uncomfortable, one, or when I was with somebody that I didn't really like find enjoyable to be with.
Social lubricant. At least you can put up with them that way.
Yeah. And then, you know, as like now that I'm a little bit older and I've got a little bit more in touch with myself, I started to realize, you know, oh, you know, if I don't want to drink around you, it means I really like you because I can actually tolerate this conversation.
Feel a genuine connection. Yeah, sure. Totally.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about when you were younger. So did you get involved in substances like early in life or no?
I started drinking 13, 14-ish, just whenever I could. You know, I'm just a very typical alcoholic. Like, I feel much better when I'm doing this. I would like to do this. But you just don't have the opportunity when you're 14 to, you know, go to liquor stores and stock up. And, you know, typical high school, I mean, there was some weed somewhere along the line, you know, that kind of thing. Not unusual experience, but I know that I liked it and wanted to do it as much as possible. So by college, it definitely was a regular thing. Yeah, as soon as I was out of the house.
College can be quite the place.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was in D.C. in 88 to 92. And then Marion Barry was the mayor. I don't know if you remember that story. The mayor was smoking crack. So it was like, hey, what, you know, when in Rome, right?
So like if all of your idols and everyone who's supposed to be your leaders, you know, who you're supposed to look up to, they're doing the same thing.
Well, or they were my inspiration to do it. I mean, I don't know if you ever read any William Burroughs, so I think it's just an absolute genius. Like, I need to get some first-person insight into how to write like that. Not exactly the best role models.
How is that? I'm not familiar.
Oh, William Burroughs is kind of the patron saint of junkies. He wrote a book called Naked Lunch, which is kind of burning the bridge to rationality. He wrote a lot of books, and he also was an artist, a painter too, and he just quite a significant cultural figure. I think everybody should at least get into him a little bit. But he was just so outside the norm of what I considered, you know, boring suburbia. You know, but in these incredibly creative, artistic, liquid pages and chapters, there were these incredible biting satire of, you know, capitalism. And it just really some fascinating, intriguing stuff. And a lot of it's very dense and a lot of it's very crazy, you'd think, because he was always in altered states when he was writing. But I was drawn to that. You know, I was definitely drawn to, you know, getting outside of oneself and finding out what you can summon when you're in the midst of the madness.
It's one thing to be the person who looks up to somebody and you think, okay, they're creative because they're crazy, or they're creative because they, you know, they do things that are out of the norm, things that, you know, aren't traditional. But what about being that person? like the person who other people are looking up to. How is that?
Yeah. Exhausting. Especially this year. And well, you know, it's humbling on a daily basis, and I try to be incredibly gracious about it. My phone does ring off the hook this year, especially. I mean, my rule of thumb this year is, and I say this literally 10 times a week, if you're not anxious right now, you're doing something wrong. Shit is fucked up, yo, is just the catchphrase on a daily basis. You know, and I discovered very early on, like I said, that, you know, 90 days sober, I went to this very low bottom rehab and told my story, and people responded very positively to it. And I didn't really know what to do with that feeling. Like, whoa, that actually helped. And I discovered that I had this talent for public speaking in regards to inspiring people, which is not something I had ever planned to do. You know, I was going to die with a needle in my arm. That was the goal. Make some art, die as a junkie. Cool. Okay. So this is just like, I don't even know what this is all about. And it absolutely fed into my ego. It absolutely, you know, I was helping people left and right and too much and sacrificing way too much of myself, but it was feeding my ego. It made me feel good. It was almost probably an addiction to some extent. And what happens is in recovery is the vast majority of people don't stay sober. And there's a lot of death. The reality is the longer we go, the stronger the drugs are, and the quicker people don't make it. You know, it used to be your average alcoholic was getting sober at 50. And these days people are coming in as teenagers, you know, and getting sober because with fentanyl, and I mean, it's just insane. And what I discovered was that if I take credit for the victories and the successes, then I'm also going to have to take emotional credit for the failures. And there are way more failures than there are successes in recovery. So it occurred to me that I have to tailor my expectations and tailor my emotional boundaries to be like, just do what you can, and then that's all you can do. Whether or not they do anything with this knowledge or this information, or whether or not they feel strongly about me or not, it's on them to whether or not they're going to get sober. You know, it's flattering. I had a couple people today just paying me huge compliments. I'm like, you're welcome. Cool. Onward and upward. You know, just whatever. Got to get out of here. I got a podcast to go do. I'll see you next week.
Oh, man. I mean, I feel like that can be a lot of pressure, you know, and like
it used to be.
As a teacher, I felt super guilty quitting my job, like,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
because I was like, I felt like I had a responsibility to my students and like, who's there for the kids right now that the world's crazy?
Well, I worked for four different rehabs over about 10 years before I went out on my own. And all of them had aspects that were incredibly unhealthy, overworked, underpaid. I had a program director that absolutely had a drinking problem. There was a psychiatrist that is now in prison because he opened up basically an open air drug market in Philly. It was like 10 years later after I had been downsized because he didn't believe in recovery. He just thought medication was the answer. He and two of his doctor buddies, the Fed swooped in. This is about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. It was like the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention or something in South Philly. They basically had, you come in with cash and we'll give you unlimited prescriptions for Xanax and Suboxone. Suboxone is like an opiate substitute. And they had made about $5 million. Literally dealers were coming in with briefcases full of cash and they would just give them unlimited prescriptions and they could just stock up on drugs. And the DEA stopped in and they're all in prison now. But I was like, I reported that guy at one point. I mean, they're just, it was brutal. And the last place I worked at, the CEO had relapsed, was drinking, and was a narcissist, and was yelling all the time. And we were like, I'm not dealing with this anymore. Like, I'm working with teenagers. It's a draining job. I loved it. I had a lot of success. And this guy treated us like complete crap. And I was like, I don't like coming into work anymore. And I resigned pretty abruptly, and I felt horrible for the kids. You know, it was like June. It was like just coming up to the summer. They were out of school. They needed some support. But I was sacrificing my own peace of mind and my own well-being. You know, and I just couldn't take it anymore. Like, I'm out. And I actually, that was like kind of the turning point in terms of, I had about 11 years sober and I'd been basically doing the workaholism thing and I was just expending way too much of myself for my clients. And I realized that. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to keep doing it because I had just given so much of my emotional capital. I just didn't have the energy at night and on the weekends to go out or do anything or develop much of a life. And I just kind of took a breath and I took some time off and actually went to Tuscany for a couple of weeks. Because if you need to make a major life change, go somewhere where you don't speak the language because you just, everything is like takes effort. You know, the things you normally take for granted. Like I struggle to communicate. It was amazing. Plus the coffee is ridiculous. Anyway, I came back and the phone rang and it was a musician because of my background in the industry. I was starting to get referrals from, you know, managers and musicians, because this may shock you, but it turns out sometimes, you know, musicians abuse drugs and alcohol. And he said, I know, right? I'm glad you were sitting down. And he said, look, my girlfriend's on the tour and we're fighting a lot and we need some help. So would you get on the bus? And I was like, dude, I'm not a couples counselor. Under no circumstances do I want any of that. And he said, well, you know, we're going to be in Camden in like 2 weeks or something. Camden is, you know, I'm in Philly, so it's like an hour away. It's like, dude, I'm not interested. And he goes, well, we're going to pay you. And I was like, you know what? I could probably pack a bag. I could do 5 days. I could. And it turned out I ended up staying for 2 weeks, and then the band wanted me to keep going, and other bands heard about it. And so it literally, you know, just by the end of that year, I kind of had a private practice, and through no fault of my own.
It's funny how those things happen, right? It's like you think you're stepping away from something, and it can be really hard to do.
Yeah.
But when you kind of just follow your gut instinct, you know, sometimes things just happen.
That's, yeah, when you make a major life change and things work out, it's like, okay, that was the move. You know, like Mike Shea from Alternative Press got in touch and said, would you do some columns for the magazine? And they went kind of viral. That was 2012. So, well, this is ridiculous.
Oh, man. So how did that feel?
Validating. You know, it's like when you're working for people and you are giving everything you have and they treat you badly and then you resign and then you, hey, look over here. You guys were totally holding me back and my life is totally kicking ass. Go fuck yourself, you know?
I feel that so much.
Yeah, pardon my French. Yeah, it's nice, you know? It's like if I ever run any of those people on the street, I'll just be like, man, did you guys fucking drop the ball? Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Has that allowed you to do so much more than you ever expected?
I don't know. Honestly, I'm a huge narcissist. So if 21 years ago you had said to me, where are you going to be in 20 years? And I would have said to you, well, let's see, I'm going to work with rock stars and go on tour for a living. And in my free time, I will escort kids with terminal illnesses to shows, because I did a bunch of that, like with the Make-A-Wish. Yeah, totally.
That's cool.
Literally exactly how I would have dictated it, because I'm such a douche. And I would have been like, yeah, sure, that's going to work out. And here I am. So yeah, it's totally cool.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, and I think these are, I love a story where it's like, I didn't really know where things were going to lead. Yeah. I followed my instinct, right, and here I am. And I think there's a lot of value in that. And I think people need to hear it, because a lot of times we get in our own way.
Yeah, totally.
And we overthink things.
Well, we were talking about the self-sabotage earlier, where, you know, you're with the wrong guy and you just do everything you possibly can to make it work, as opposed to the right guy going, okay, go fuck yourself. I'll just, you know, you're absolutely right. And I remember when I was in treatment and they said, tell thine own self be true. And I was like, that's fantastic, but I don't know who the fuck I am, you know? And the first step is you got to figure out who you are and what you like and what you don't like and where you fit in the world. And that takes a decade, you know? And then once you do that, like for me, I realized that unless I do stay true to myself, I'm going to be miserable. Like I did stay at jobs longer than I should have, thinking, but who's going to help the kids? Well, you know what? They'll find somebody else, because this job's fucking killing me. You know, it's like, is it worth sacrificing myself? And it's not. Like, I'm a person, I count, and I want to start valuing my own happiness. And it took me 10, 11 years sober to realize that I can work half as many hours, make a pretty good living, and be much more happy than I used to be, you know, and that elusive balance. I mean, my first 10, 11 years sober, I was absolutely a workaholic. Not even in hours, but in terms of just how much I was giving of myself. And this second decade that I just completed, I really got in touch with what's going to make me happy, you know?
Yeah, and it kind of gives you energy too when you actually are passionate about something, you know, even if it makes you tired. How was your parents? How did the way that they interacted, or the way that they had a relationship with you, how do you think that affected you?
Like growing up?
Yeah, growing up.
We had a not a dysfunctional family. We had our quirks, as every family does. You know, we were poor growing up, but there was support and love all day, every day. I honestly, compared to a lot of people, zero complaints. Unbelievably supportive family. Then when it came out that I had a problem, they just rallied around me, you know, and gave me the opportunity to go to treatment. There's literally nothing I could complain about family-wise, and have continued to be incredibly supportive. You know, I was a pretty distant person before I got sober. You know, I turned 18, moved out of state. You know, I wanted to get away from the small little town I grew up in and the family that loved me, and let's get away from all that and be dangerous. you know, and having gotten sober in the first couple of years, you know, I just have this really open and honest and lovely relationship with my family. It's great.
It's interesting that you say, you know, you had a family that really provided a lot of love, but you were kind of, do you feel like you were running away from it?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I couldn't handle, and most alcoholics can't handle people loving them like that. I can't handle that. So I will try to throw money at the problem or just be angry at you and drive you away. I'll externalize some guilt, you know, and it took growing up. You know, I was 28 when I got sober, to growing up to realize, to find out what unconditional love meant, you know? I mean, I just couldn't comprehend that. What do you mean? You people are forgiving me. I lied to you. I manipulated. I stole from you. You know, that's what alcoholics do. They're like, it doesn't matter. Just get better. And I'm like, why are you okay with this? What the hell is wrong with you people? You know?
Like, what? Like, why? How can you tolerate me? I don't understand.
You're not making any sense. Yeah.
Man, so I listened to a podcast that you were on, and you talked a lot about like opiates and things, and how physical pain, like it's something that starts with physical pain, and then there's drugs that get layered, and then you end up just, you know, down the rabbit hole.
Sure.
And that really, like, that really spoke to me, because I have experience with, you know, with my son's dad. He had a knee surgery. That's how it started. Oh. Well, it started before that, because he had also, he was a bodybuilder. Oh. So I think it started with steroids and growth hormone. But then he had a knee surgery. Mm. And then that's where the opiate thing started. Okay. Because of, you know, Vicodin. Sure. And things like, yeah, that. And then it just snowballed, and it completely, you know, he dropped out of college, and but he ended up dying from what they said was cardiac arrest.
Huh.
At 26.
Wow.
And his father.
And was there any history of heart issues? Yeah.
Well, he had an enlarged heart. And so I think from the combination of the growth hormone and like all, you know, all the drugs, like, you know, that definitely couldn't have helped.
Right.
But, you know, his father also had a history of that, because he was a Vietnam vet. He had a history of drug use.
PTSD probably. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And just constantly on opiates, but he would also sometimes take Xanax. Yeah. With it. And, you know, so I witnessed this, and it was like, everybody loved them so much. And sometimes I wonder, like, the people who were left behind. You know, like, I think about my mother-in-law, you know, like, how does she feel? Like, do you ever deal with the people involved that are left behind? And what are the types of questions that they deal with? And how do they get affected?
Well, we call it, alcoholism is a family disease, because it's not like it just affects the person. And the people that the alcoholic hurts the most are the people that love them. You know, the innocent bystanders, the collateral damage. When you see the people left behind, meaning when someone dies?
Yeah, when someone dies, but or even just when, you know, you love someone, yeah, so much and they run away from,
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Well, it's hard, because you're trying to mourn the loss of the person, but they're still around. So it's almost like you're stuck in this limbo of wanting them to get better, not wanting them to get worse, but there's nothing you can do. And you just have to kind of quietly watch from a distance, and it's really painful. You know, that's Al-Anon is a really good program for people with a loved one. You know, you can go and you can at least relate to other people and develop some emotional boundaries. Because it's hard. It's a hard thing to deal with. Dealing with people in active addiction is just, you know, crippling emotionally.
How do you deal with the emotions that come from having these interactions with these people who are going through so much?
Well, it took time. You know, I mean, my first couple, 3, 4, 5 years, I didn't have a whole lot in the way of emotional boundaries. I mean, I started being a counselor when I had 3.5 years sober, which is really early. And I would think about my clients all weekend, you know, and at night, and putting together, okay, that woman needs to talk about her dad, and I think he's got an issue with, which is exhausting, you know, on Saturday afternoon, having revelations about your clients. And I needed to, somebody once described it as kind of building a callus. You know, it really is when you're playing guitar over and over again and you slowly develop those calluses so that it doesn't hurt you as much. You know, I mean, it's not that I'm numb to it. I still feel it, but I've done it enough times that I can do it and work through it. You know, I'm still compassionate and I still want to help people, but I can turn it off on Friday night, you know, and sleep in. And I didn't turn my phone off my first probably 5, 6 years sober, because somebody might call me at 2 a.m. and I was going to save them from drinking. The reality is, if they're going to drink at 2 a.m., they're going to drink, you know, whether or not they call me or not. And, you know, 6 years in, I just turned my phone off at night.
Did you have a need to save people?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah. There's also a big chunk of survivor's guilt when you just get sober and stay sober. You see all these other people falling by the wayside, and it's like, well, why am I still okay? Like, I got to do something. I better, you know, just save the world, which, you know, is exhausting.
Yeah, you're like Atlas, like the weight of the world.
I need to shrug. What are you kidding me?
Oh, man. So there was something else that you said. You mentioned that, you know, and well, it kind of goes back into the part where you were like, oh, you know, sobriety and like the whole thing, like it's kind of like cultish and like I'm not into it. It's so lame. But you said that people have this tendency to say, oh, well, yeah, like that's fine. It works for those people, but it definitely won't work for me. What do you think that comes from?
Just rationalizing, you know, the idea that I'm going to actually have to do a lot of work to get sober. And I don't think that works for me. So I'll just blame that support group or that therapist didn't help me or, you know, I'm not going to do the fucking work. That sounds awful. It sounds like I'm going to have to get used to living sober. I don't want to do that. And you see it all the time, you know, whether it's a drug addict that decides maybe I can get away with drinking or maybe I'll just smoke pot all the time. I will substitute anything but actually getting better. Yeah, that's what that is.
Yeah, and you said it's a sense of entitlement too, right? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, the whole idea of I'm entitled to feel good all the time, which just isn't realistic, you know? Nobody feels good all the time. But alcoholics and addicts, we have that false sense that we need to dispel that illusion. Like there are going to be times in life that just absolutely suck. And you need to just be okay with that. Like I was talking to a guy the other day who he was struggling with sobriety and then his Saturday he woke up and nothing went his way. And he knew he could either call someone and talk about it or isolate, which would make him feel worse, or call someone to make him feel better. And I suggested, or you can actually just acknowledge the fact that you're feeling really anxious today and just feel it. Because I wasn't capable of doing that previously. Like I have to do something, which was usually make it worse. But just the idea of just, you know, what do I do with these feelings? You feel them. That's what you do to process it.
Yeah, it can be really tough to realize that, like, a lot of times the best action is no action at all, right?
Right, right. Don't just do something. Sit there.
Tell me, I'm curious, what other things do you do? Like, what if I tried to describe you to somebody, what are the things that light you up and that, you know, you do outside of your job?
Art is the only thing that makes life bearable. And it doesn't matter what kind of art, as long as it elicits emotion. I collect art. I'm friends with a lot of artists. I go to gallery openings all the time. I garden, I cook, I build furniture. Like, you know, it's like, because I don't go out anymore, this year, I don't actually like people in some ultimate irony. So this has been the best excuse for me to people like, hey, we want to come over. And I'm like, no, sorry, there's a global pandemic. You know, but woodworking, and I've been designing industrial lighting fixtures because I bought a house in 2010 that was foreclosed. It was a fixer-upper. And I have just slowly over the last 10 years fixed her up it. And it's, I'm down, I got one bathroom to go. And I've literally remodeled an entire house, which is a thing. You know, like I never restored hardwood floors before or put floors down or, you know. I'm building light fixtures and I built a table because I like mid-century modern stuff. And I was like, why don't I just do it myself?
I love mid-century modern.
I'll send you a picture.
Thank you. So what is it about? What is it about? Because it sounds like you like projects. So what is it about having something tangible that you could work with that you love?
What isn't about having something tangible? Hey, look, I accomplished stuff. You know, it's a good feeling. I like it. I like getting my hands on things, taking them apart, and putting it back together in a cooler way. You know, I have this bathroom that was in the late 80s. There were two colors of tile. There was the pink and the sky blue. Apparently, those are the only two options. So I have this one bathroom that is sky blue. At least I didn't get the pink. But there was, you know, lighting fixture that is just frosted 1988 glass. It's so disco and so hideous. And if I've discovered I have this ability, if I stare at something long enough, like it clicks what I can do with it. And I just pulled the whole light fixture off the wall, and I took the white enamel base, and I sprayed it, you know, oil rubbed bronze is kind of the hip color now. And so I got some metallic spray and did that. And then I got these Edison bulbs, and it's all of a sudden this really cool industrial light fixture. That's, you know, the exact opposite. It's 1988 fucking tacky disco. And it's like, this is fantastic. This is, you know, I just, the idea of dictating my environment and just getting to be creative with every room of the house. It's a lot of fun.
Did you always think of yourself as a creative, or is that something that happened like post sobriety?
I think I'm more than likely, I think the reason I'm so drawn to artists and musicians is because I was always a frustrated creative artist. You know, I loved Legos as a kid, and I was always trying to make stuff. And it's probably a control thing, you know, part of controlling my environment. But it's a lot of fun. It's satisfying. And the idea of getting to play a tiny little role in these people actually getting their shit together and then creating works of art that they never even thought they were capable of and giving me some of that credit is just incredibly cool.
That's so cool. I have an appreciation for people who are creative, right? And I do feel like every human is creative. Like in our essence, I think that we have it. However, I think that a lot of people tend to feel that either, you know, yes, it's you're born with it. There's also a school of thought that through enough practice, you can get good at it. But then there's also a part of some people who think that, you know, creativity only comes when you shut off, you know, the other part of yourself that overanalyzes things. Where do you fall in there?
I think all of the above. I think some people are innately creative. I think that unless they actually apply that skill, though, I mean, no, it doesn't just come to anyone. You know, it's always going to require practice to get better at anything. I think some people aren't creative. You ever watched the movie Exit Through the Gift Shop, the Banksy movie?
No, I didn't. No.
It was amazing. Do yourself a favor. It's fantastic. He's such a genius. But he was talking about how he used to say, I think everybody should make some art. And then there's an absolute disaster that goes on with a guy that basically subverts the entire art industry. And he goes, yeah, I don't really say that anymore. You know, like I think everybody, if they did pursue a little creativity, the world would be a better place. But I think most people are too afraid to actually do something cool. Not that the world doesn't need accountants. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, it's important. My taxes are complicated. But I think everybody should at least try. They absolutely should. You know, go build a bookcase. You know, go do something. Because it really feels good when you do.
Yeah, you're totally right. It's that fear. What do you think that fear is? And where do you think it comes from?
Well, I think everybody's got a little bit of fear of inadequacy. And it's what you do with it. You know, most people allow it to, you know, limit them. I mean, a really wise man once said to me, 95% of the reason people don't have the job they want is because they're too afraid to apply. And the only reason you get through that is you just every single day you keep showing up and you face your fears. I mean, getting sober is like making a list of everything you're afraid of and then just facing every single one of your fears. And you eventually develop some faith and some confidence in yourself.
I love that.
You know, before you're dictating your entire life. I mean, like, I love helping people and I love musicians and my career is literally both of those combined in one. And I've built a house and, you know, people come into my life and they go, wow, dude, you've got so much cool shit going on. It's like, well, you can too. You just got to do the work. And that's part of the problem is not everybody's willing to do the work.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's also, you know, it's identifying that fear and putting a name to it and then just doing it. And putting yourself in an uncomfortable situation.
Yeah. Getting through the fear is everybody feels it. It's what you do with it. It's whether or not you face the fears and just keep showing up. Yeah.
Yeah. How is that? When you have to deal with something that's really scary for you, how does it feel? Like what does it do to you physically? And how do you deal with it?
I'm trying to think of the last time. I mean, I know that my first year sober, there was everything. And my second year was half of that stuff I was afraid of. And, you know, it's just I had a lot of anxiety growing up, which was just fear. I just didn't really know how to connect with people and be social and interact and succeed. And as the longer I've stayed sober, you know, you develop this confidence in yourself that, like, I've gotten through all these crazy things. Like, for me, when I got sober, and I would listen to other people telling their story about maintaining sobriety, and I couldn't fathom people making it through tragedy or loss or grief and staying sober through it. That's, I just couldn't, because for me, like breaking a shoelace was like a 2-week bender. Like, oh my God, I have it so bad. I can't. So once you've stuck around for long enough, you know, you realize I can probably stay sober through anything. And it's just a question of applying that toward all the other areas of your life. You know, one of the great things about sobriety is I have something that I can be grateful for every day. You know, I know a lot of people struggle with gratitude. And you stay sober long enough, it's like, in addition to all the other cool stuff in my life, you know, I've got this foundation of, I'm not hungover. I'm not dope sick today. Life's pretty good. And not everybody has that. You know, a lot of people take a lot for granted.
Yeah, I think taking things for granted is something that it's just the easy thing to do. And, you know, and that's why we lean toward it. But being able to recognize that and then actually working towards it and trying to figure out ways that you can identify things in your life that you are grateful for is really important.
I usually tell everybody, you know, right before you go to bed, make a list of three things you're grateful for. And if you do that for 3 weeks, it will literally change your thinking.
Why do you think it changes your thinking?
Well, because you stop taking things for granted. Most of us don't sit around going, what am I grateful for? And we don't do it. And we should. We'd be a better species.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a society where the news is updated instantly. People's lives are updated instantly. I mean, there's just stuff being bombarded at you constantly. And I think the only way to be happy is if you slow down and focus on, you know, and I'm guilty of it all the time, God knows. I'm going to get into an internet fight about politics at least once more later tonight, you know, at least once more. but then I like to go out to the backyard and sit down in the grass, you know, and just feel and listen to the birds or the crickets, depending on what time of day it is. And, you know, like I have a garden. I mean, I didn't have the patience to plant things and 6 months later harvest, you know. But every year I give myself a new culinary challenge. Like I want to be able to make pasta sauce only from things I grow in the garden. And then it was like, I'm going to make hot sauce just out of stuff I grow in the garden. You know, and every year it's just something else. It's fun.
So is that goal setting mentality that you have that you apply to your garden and you apply to cooking and things? Is that something that you used while you were becoming sober?
I think becoming sober for me was just about time. Was getting 6 months under my belt, and then a year and then 2 years. That was really the most important thing.
Well, those are goals, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's just like that was the whole priority for me. It was just sobriety was everything. I mean, it still is, you know, the foundation of everything in my life that's good. God knows if I went back out, it would all go away. But, you know, over time, like for most of us, our first year, every day that I'm sober is a victory. It's the biggest thing imaginable. And then you hit a year and you can actually say to yourself, okay, I think I've got that piece down. Now it's all this other stuff that I've been avoiding my whole life, emotional responsibility and interacting with people in a healthy way and identifying emotions. And, you know, so that was kind of the goal for years two through now, you know, a couple of decades later, still getting halfway decent at expressing myself.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's like every day is a small incremental goal. And then it, you know, that 6 month mark and that 12 month mark, that is a bigger goal. And so how does that compare to what you do on your free time? Like when you work on a house or when you work on a new lighting fixture, or when you cook and things like that?
Well, I think part of the problem is I meet guys that have, you know, 30 days sober, 6 months sober, and they look at my life and the whole package and they go, okay, that's awesome. How soon can I get all that stuff? Or it's just so intimidating that I have so much stuff going on. They're like, well, I'll never be that cool. And it's like, dude, it took me a really long time and a lot of work to get here. You know, it gets easier over time, but the hard part is you got to do it every day. You know, that's the dichotomy of it. It's just like exercise, you know, if I miss a day.
Yeah. And people really just see the results, right?
And I did. I mean, I saw people with 10 years sober going, well, man, that guy's got his life together. I'm never going to be that. But it's like, well, it took him some time to get there.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't see all the stumbling along the way.
That's true.
You got to be patient with yourself, but
yeah,
you got to do the work.
You know, something that really gets me is just how today with like the internet and with social media, everybody's highlights are always on the front page. You know, you only see the end product, right? You only see the light fixture or the beautiful meal that was created, but you don't see all the hard work that was put into it.
Sure.
Totally. Yeah.
Well, and also you see people doing beer bongs on Friday night going hashtag good times. You do not see the waking up covered in your vomit Saturday morning. Nobody posts that on Instagram, you know?
Yeah.
And you just have to keep that in mind. I mean, comparison really is the thief of joy. You know, you are seeing people's highlights. And one of the things in recovery circles, you hear people saying, don't compare your insides to everybody else's outsides. You know, because a lot of people, when they're feeling crappy, they'll scroll through Facebook and be like, they're all having so much fun. They're probably not. They're just posting stuff. I feel like people post what they're most insecure about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, look how spiritual I am when they're really not. Or look how great my relationship is. They're totally cheating on each other. you know? And it's like, for me, I just post about politics because they terrify me right now.
They do. I have this really weird thing with social media where, like, I have a hard time posting, like, I don't know, like pictures of myself and, like, you know, things like that. And it's funny because, like, now in like social media, like the expectation is for you to put yourself out there in order to, you know, be successful at it. But, like, I just have this weird thing where I'm just like, yeah, like, I don't really want to do that. How, like,
I don't really post anything personal. It's just not my thing.
But people have a real need to.
Well, that's ego. Yeah. That's insecurity and ego. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's your average unhealthy person is an egomaniac with low self-esteem. You know, they think about themselves all day long, but they don't think very highly of themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can tell a lot about a person by what they post. And it magnifies the type of person you are. So if you're insecure, it's absolutely going to magnify that. Mm-hmm. I think most normal, healthy people probably don't post much at all. I post about politics and I accuse all my sober friends of being on meth. That's the extent of my interacting on social media.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, something that you mentioned too before is that over the past few years, people have been lost in clusters, is the word that you used.
Yeah.
What do you think has changed over the past few years that has really led to things kind of unraveling so quickly?
Oh, man, how much time do we have? That's a hard question to answer. I think that there's something about this society that we've only been around for a couple hundred years, and we have money and technology out the wazoo. And we don't seem to be grounded very well. And there's just this constant, you know, I think it's just a combination of a lot of things, you know, the polarization, hypercapitalism. I think we've kind of lost our way in terms of community. I think we don't look out for each other as much as we could, or some people don't. And I think selfishness is admired in terms of success. You know, you can get ahead more if you're selfish, and then, you know, and which is true. I mean, I know some CEOs that I've worked under were horrible human beings, but everybody wanted to have the big car and the nice car, so they figured they got to be that way in order to stab people in the back. You know, and it's just the confluence of all the stuff. And then you add in some social media where the guy with the really nice car is posting pictures and people are responding to that. And so it just becomes a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy. I was talking to a friend of mine from college who just seems incredibly angry about, dude, maybe you need to unplug and go for a run. I'm literally 12 hours ago, he was not 12, 8 hours ago. He was just coming after a whole bunch of us in a couple of different threads and calling us names. And it's like, dude, we all love this guy. We've known him for 30 years, but something's not right. And, you know, it's part and parcel of what's going on in the world today. It's just everybody seems to be spiraling off in angry directions, which is really kind of fucking sad.
Yeah, it is. You're right. It's that sense of community is really, and especially like in the United States, you know, we glorify individuals and we don't really recognize like everything that goes on behind the scenes in order to get that individual where they are. I mean, even, you know, our economy, you know, it's like nobody cares about the small businesses and the workers and the people who are actually doing the work. They only care about the stock price, which is really just a reflection of rich people's feelings. So, you know.
Well, yeah, and how their companies are doing. I mean, one of the things I buy art usually from the artists and occasionally from the art galleries that support those artists, like this year, because I know everybody's kind of struggling. And I'm actually having a pretty good year because, shockingly enough, my phone rings off the hook, as opposed to, you know, going to big chain stores and, you know, I build my own furniture. I try to be a little less of a consumer. Like, you know, I had a vacuum cleaner that wasn't working. And I think normally you just throw it in the trash. And I didn't want a big piece of plastic and metal to go in a landfill. So I took it out of the backyard with a couple of screwdrivers and took it apart. And it turned out there were three huge clogs in it of lint, which, you know, and then now it works like new again. And I don't know how many people would take the time to do that these days because we live in the kind of culture where just throw it away. And I think if we all took a little more time and slowed down a little bit, I don't know if that's realistic or not. I mean, I don't have kids, so it's not like, you know, I can take the time to do that. God knows it's not realistic for everybody. But there's something to be said for, you know, like I know some people that are from a Scandinavian country where the taxes are decently higher, but healthcare is covered, higher education is covered. And they're like, we don't understand how you wouldn't do it this way. We're okay with paying higher taxes because that way everybody's okay. And that's just, it's a completely different mindset than we have here, where it's just kind of.
Here, a lot of people, you know, it's that whole pick yourself up by your bootstraps, yeah, and the society as a whole and the community doesn't owe you anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's a fundamental problem that we have.
Well, and I know a lot of people that were born on third and think they hit a triple. And it's like, no, dude, you've got a lot that we're just handed. Maybe you should just be grateful for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, I just, you know, it's interesting because now I feel like a lot of people are starting to talk about these things. It's like we're starting to see, you know, for real, you know, it's like somebody's taking a black light to America. We're discovering all of these things that have always been underlying.
I mean, not unlike alcoholism. It's like, it's a shame that it had to get this bad for us to go, wait a minute, something's horrible. I mean, we've been heading in this direction for a while. I don't want to name any names, but it, you know, like the thing about alcoholism is a symptom of something being wrong internally. Like, I don't want to name any names, but there may or may not be a central figure that is a symptom of how we ended up here and why we'd be attracted to a guy like that. And
hey, we just like being in an abusive relationship.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. And maybe we should break up with the current one and just find ourselves for a minute. Maybe we don't need a new guy to lead us for a minute. We'll just kind of, yeah, take our time this time around.
We'll just be single for a while.
Yeah,
we
just need to be single for ourselves. A while. I think that's totally the move.
Oh, I love that so much. So I'm curious because I know that, you know, behind the lessons that we learn in life and behind all of the positive things that, you know, we inevitably end up bringing to the world at some point, hopefully, you know, at least even if it's just one thing, yeah, there's always something behind that. So was there ever anybody that really helped you through the really hard times and something that they said to you that helps you continue on the right path?
Well, sure. I mean, there've been countless people that have inspired me over the years. You know, from public figures to just people I interacted with over the years. I mean, there was a guy who, the last facility I worked at, although the CEO was a horrible person, there was a VP who was kind of semi-retired. He was in his 70s. But he'd been in the field for probably 40 years, and he was probably sober 47 or 48 years when he passed away. And he was a giant in the field. Before there was really a field of recovery, he'd gotten his master's in probably the 70s, and there wasn't a whole lot of drug and alcohol counseling going on then. But he said to me once, for every 10 sessions I get paid for, I do one pro bono. And I was like, wow, that's actually kind of really awesome advice, because you still get that feel for, you know, helping somebody that probably couldn't afford me otherwise. Like when 2 months ago, when CAA, Creative Artists Agency, laid off a third of their staff, you know, with the music industry, everybody's out of work and it seems to come and go in waves. And just when people get a little hopeful, the bottom drops out again. So 2 months ago that happened, and I got on a music industry forum and said, I'm doing pro bono groups for Thursday, every Thursday this month, because people are freaking out. You know, it's like they keep hoping to get back to work, and it's like, no, it's going to look like maybe even into next year. So I did that in the month of August, and then they really still needed it. So we're still doing it every Thursday in September, and we'll see what happens next month. But the whole idea of, you know, being able to do some work for free for people that probably couldn't afford it otherwise is pretty great. You know, it's exhausting, but it's pretty great, and they're all very appreciative.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to the whole lead with empathy.
Yeah, sure.
And do everything, you know, like I feel like when you give more, you do end up getting more in return. And it also fuels you so you can keep going.
To a point, because God knows I've gotten strung out on, you know, I mean, I had compassion fatigue many times in my career, and I like need to take the weekend off and shut my phone off.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but so it's okay to take a little bit of time off. I mean, you don't have to keep giving constantly.
Well, that was 10, 11 years in, I realized I can actually, you know, if they choose to stay sober, they will. And it's not contingent on whether or not I pick up the phone at 2 a.m.
Yeah. And you can't give from an empty cup, you know?
Well, that's just it. You know, that's exactly right. And I was empty for a while. And still am from time to time. You know, and then I just add to cart, you know, go buy some art, put it on my walls, and it makes me happy.
I love it. You feed your soul.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Well, this was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I think people caring more is really important. And I think that the more that we talk about caring for other people and, you know, really being there for each other, I think the more that it's going to not be so culty and off-putting for people, you know?
It's not like it was. Things have really gotten very demystified. I mean, there are very few people that haven't heard of recovery circles and where to go if you need help. Yeah, so it's definitely different than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and we're talking about the stigma of mental health, you know, and the walls are slowly coming down. At least I hope they are.
I think so.
But thank you so much for having me. This was great. I'm really glad we did this.
Absolutely. All right. Well, have a great night. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Here are some key takeaways from my conversation with Dave Sherman. 1. The thing that keeps you struggling is contempt prior to investigation. Take a look at your preconceived notions and realize that getting rid of them will help you evolve as a person. 2. It's important to understand self-sabotage as a real player in our lives. If we don't feel worthy of happiness, we will take actions that reinforce that feeling of low self-esteem and alienation. One way to counteract it is by doing things to help others. It will inevitably help you learn to love yourself. 3. When you find that you're sacrificing your own peace of mind and well-being, don't be afraid to walk away. 4. The first step on the path to finding your way in life is to figure out who you are, what you like, what you don't like, where you fit in the world, and what your values are. Be patient, it can take a while. And 5, don't allow your fear to limit you. As with recovery, showing up every single day and facing your fears one by one really is key. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life podcast. Be sure to give Dave a follow on Instagram at @FavidSherman. And don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow The Tour Life on Instagram @TheTourLifePodcast.